Morena, a very good morning to Susie Wiles.
Good morning.
Associate Professor Susie Wiles of Auckland University and head of its bioluminescence lab. I think I've got it all, some of it.
How are you, Catherine?
I'm well, thank you. Going a little bit dotty, as you can, as you can tell. Let's begin, shall we? Everyone wants to know about the hornets, so let's not run out of time. But let's begin with the study that you want to refer to on transmission. The issue of asymptomatic versus
pre-symptomatic. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah, this is so important. So, obviously, a COVID-19 related study. And what I'm kind of blown away by is that, you know, it's only been a few months since this virus appeared. And we've gone from knowing nothing to now actually having kind of clinical trials of stuff. It's just amazing. But there's still so much that we don't know. And my research interests are really around transmission of infectious diseases, because as we're seeing from this virus, you know, that who infects who and how and when are so crucial to understanding how we can stop these viruses. And that's actually one of the hardest bits to study, at least in the lab. And so when you know, for example, for this one, we've got so many questions because lots of people are worried that people who don't have symptoms are infectious. But there is this clear distinction between, is that somebody who never has symptoms or is that somebody who does have symptoms at some point? Because being able to trace somebody and do this contact tracing is very difficult if somebody never develops symptoms. But it's much more easy if somebody does at least at some point develop symptoms. And so this sort of idea of that there were these truly asymptomatic people who were infectious kind of started quite early on when there was a study published in a very prestigious medical journal, and its title was Transmission of the Infection from an Asymptomatic Contact. But it turned out that the people who wrote the paper, they didn't actually contact this person who had had the virus to ask if they had symptoms. They based it on interviews with the people that they saw who all said, oh no, that person didn't have symptoms. And then it turns out when some other German health officials contacted this index case, the person, they said, yes, I did have symptoms. But still that paper appears in the medical literature as, you know, as this example of how you can get this asymptomatic spread. Anyway, so what are the ways that we can look at this? One of the most important thing, I guess, we have is to look at clusters. And so there, by really examining within a cluster who got the disease and how did they get it, we can start to answer some of these questions. And this is what has just appeared from researchers in Taiwan, who I have to say, I mean, Taiwan is just kicking everybody's butt when it comes to controlling this disease, right? They are not really getting the press that they need. So they've had 438 cases in total and 6 deaths, you know, and they're right on the doorstep of China. And it turns out the key to their success has been having a vice president who's an infectious diseases specialist. And they had a pandemic plan that was really suitable, and they put in action as soon as the first cases appeared in China. And so while they've only had this small number, they've also done this incredible piece of work looking at 100 of the cases and really teasing out in huge detail who got it from whom and when. So of those 100 cases, they had 2,761 close contacts. So these are people living in the same house. They're people who are family members but not living in the same house. And then other people who, you know, the people with COVID-19 have had close contact with. So that was healthcare professionals, people they worked with, things like that. And so the first question they asked was, do these properly asymptomatic people exist? And the answer to that was very clearly yes. So of the 100 cases they had, 9 of those people did not have any symptoms. So then the next question is, are those people infectious? And it looks like they're not. So there were no further cases from any of those 9 people who didn't have symptoms. So this is a really important bit of the puzzle. We'd want to see more studies that looked at this, but that's pretty good evidence. The next question then was, so do people who have mild disease, are they infectious? And because, again, that's, you know, important. If you are unwell but not so unwell that you decide to stay home, then obviously that also increases the chances of people getting infected. And so the answer to that was yes. So those people there were other transmissions from those cases, but not as much as those who had more severe disease. So that's sort of really interesting, and maybe talks about how much virus people might be shedding. But again, there's lots of work to do around that. And then the third question was, who got infected? And so actually, of those close contacts, only 5% were these household contacts, just like 3% were non-household, but a quarter of them were healthcare contacts. So, you know, I guess in Taiwan, their response was somebody has the virus, you take them away and you put them, you know, essentially in hospital. But what they found was that those who were most at risk of getting the infection were actually the people who lived in the same household and the family members who lived in different households. And so that really shows that it's the people who we're repeatedly spending a lot of time with, especially in the early stages of infection, where you know, who are at risk. And that's it then also something they looked at. So how long did people essentially remain infectious for? And so they sort of divided it into three different groups. So those close contacts who'd only had contact with a case before the person had symptoms, those who were in the first few days, and then those who were after 6 days. And what they showed was that those people who only had contact before somebody became symptomatic, so when they were pre-symptomatic, some of those got infected. The same with those in the early stages. But anybody who had contact only after somebody had been sick for 6 days didn't come down with the illness. So again, that doesn't look like people are are infectious for a long time after they actually start having symptoms. Which again, all of these are really important things to understand. Then what are the best ways to stop it in different places? So it's just an absolutely fantastic study. And especially like this, looking at when people are infectious, because there's been a lot of worry around the fact that some people can still test positive for the virus for weeks after they've been unwell. And so we've seen possibly a case of this and maybe in Taranaki, I think. But the thing about that is that the test can't differentiate between a viable virus and just bits of broken virus, leftovers from when your body has responded to it. And so this sort of points to, it's just leftovers, after a certain period of time, which has also been backed up by some scientists in Korea who tried to isolate virus from these people who've recovered. So even though they tested positive, they actually couldn't get any live viable virus back. So it's just studies like these that are so important. And I would love to see our own clusters looked at in this way. So I really hope somebody's looking at those really clearly and then publishes them, because it's so important we get more data to really understand what's happening, especially in those countries where there are just so many cases. It's hard for them to do this kind of analysis, if that makes sense, because there might be so many different ways that people could have come into contact with the virus. Whereas countries like ours, which have got what we call a low prevalence, so there's not much virus around, it's much easier to say, that's how somebody got it, kind of thing.
Let's talk about the hornets. everybody agitated.
It's just something that appeared in my Twitter feed over the last few days. There was an article in National Geographic about these giant Asian hornets, which I'd never heard of. And so it's because they've been sighted in the USA. So they come from Asia. They're absolutely huge. Hopefully we've got a video up online that you can see them. They're like 5 centimeters in length. And they've got this quite big stinger that produces a really nasty venom. And apparently, according to the article, so in Japan, an average of 30 to 50 people die each year from these stings. But it's not people that we're worried about. It's honeybees, because apparently these hornets can destroy a honeybee colony in just hours. And again, go and have a look at the video. I mean, they come in, they start biting the worker bees' heads off because they've got these huge mandibles. And then basically once all the workers are dead, they just sort of hang out in the nest and start feeding on the pupa and the larva. So it's pretty gross. But the thing that's so cool about the story is that in Japan, so the reason they're concerned is because in Japan, the honeybees have actually evolved to combat this predator. And it's something that the honeybees in the US haven't done, because they've never been, seen this predator. So what the honeybees do is, because the Japanese ones, because their own stinger can't actually pierce the exoskeleton of the hornet, they create what's called a bee ball. So they basically swarm around this hornet, and then they create this massive ball, and then they start to vibrate, maybe by flapping their wings or just like vibrating their bodies, which raises the temperature in this ball to over 45 degrees, essentially cooking the hornets. And it's also thought that maybe it also raises the concentration of carbon dioxide, and so maybe that also helps to suffocate them. And so it's kind of amazing that
I'm just at the bit of the video when the hornet lands.
They're horrible, aren't they? I mean, they're really, it's awful to say that because they're insects, and we need insects.
I know. But still.
They are, but they're very big, and it's fabulous that these Japanese honeybees have a way to stop them. But the worry is if these hornets establish in other countries where the honeybees don't have this adaptation, then they could essentially decimate the honeybee populations there, which, of course, we need for lots of reasons.
I'm watching your video. Oh, it's brutal. This is like bee's eye view. And yeah. Once the hornet attacks, everyone else attacks him. Sorry, Susie.
It's amazing. The adaptation is
localized, is that what you're saying? And the question would be, if it happened elsewhere around the world, probably not have the adaptation. The bees wouldn't.
Yeah, so that's what they believe in the USA, that those bees, because they've never encountered this before, they don't have the same response. So what the scientists are doing is trying to stop these hornets establishing in the USA. So trying to basically work out, so putting traps down to figure out how many might be there, because they think they probably just come in on some cargo or something. And so want to try and get them before they actually establish.
That's a compelling.
Go and watch the video.
It's a compelling video. You'll find it. Thank you, Susie. You'll find it online, rnz.co.nz/9 to noon. Associate Professor Dr. Susie Wiles is our science correspondent.